This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Manner Companion Graded Reader Series. And one thing my grandpa told me, son, never explain yourself to anyone. And he never did tell me why. My co-host is John Pazden, co-founder of Manner Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese grammar wiki, Sinosplice.com. And you might not know this, but he has kleptomania. But when it gets bad, he takes something for it. In this episode, John and I give you a behind-the-scenes look at how we actually choose and adapt stories for Chinese learners like you. It's a look into how the sausage is made. And if you've read our books, you're going to get a lot more out of this. Guest interview is with Peter Braden, a Chinese history PhD with some serious Chinese chops. He's delved through the handwritten archives of China and written about the history of cows throughout the revolutionary period. True story. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah, United States.
Hey guys, I'm John Pazden. I am in Shanghai, China. Happy December.
Happy December to you too, John. Happy holidays.
We got lots of good stuff today, and we're going to jump right into some reviews and then a very, very excellent question.
We're going to start out with Pan Xiaofeng from her classroom, her students who are listening to our podcast. These podcasts are super fun and enjoyable to listen to and are very clear on how to understand. I love how they help us improve our skills for Chinese characters, pinyin, and history in general. The podcasts that I've watched are also very interesting and make me want to watch more. Mason. Mason, I think you might have meant listen, but that's okay. Thanks, Mason. And we have another one from Laura. She says, your content's helpful and enjoyable to listen to. Oh, shucks. Thanks, Laura. Lydia says, the podcast helps me understand more about the Chinese language, but also the culture. It is also more entertaining than the other ones I've heard and would recommend to others. Ah, well, all right. And then Gabriel finishes. He says, the podcast is incredible and it makes learning Chinese feel a lot more achievable. Thanks, Gabriel. We appreciate it.
Okay, so this next one is from Jeremy. And he says, hi, John and Jared. I'm a huge fan of You Can Learn Chinese. You guys are wonderful hosts and provide a lot of helpful info on learning Chinese. Thank you for all of the useful content. All the best to you guys, Jeremy. Thanks, Jeremy. We'll keep it up.
This next one comes from William Whitaker. He says, hey, Jared and John, first off, I want to say thank you. I lived in China for about a year, but worked in an English environment, so I never really took the time to study Chinese. Anyway, fast forward to this year, I was home from China and the coronavirus struck. With the extra time on my hands, I decided I'm going to learn Chinese. I have been studying in earnest for about the last 6 months and recently passed the HSK 3 exam, just barely. LOL. Hey, that's still good. I want to tell you, your guys' podcast gave me a huge morale boost and motivation to push myself in my Chinese studies. Hearing the stories of people who have succeeded in learning Chinese is a huge inspiration. Hopefully one day I can be good enough at Chinese to be a guest on your show. I hope so. Finishing and comprehending The Misadventures of Zhou Haisheng was a huge milestone for me in my language learning journey, and I bought In Search of Hua Ma immediately afterwards, and now I'm reading that as well. Thank you guys for all that you do for the millions of people out there trying to learn Chinese. You're truly making the world a better place. P.S. The memes are funny. William Whitaker. Thanks, William.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like, with this crazy year, 2020, you know, due to the virus, I didn't really think about it that much before, but it really does make this podcast more relevant because, you know, a lot of people do have the time and maybe what they need the most is the motivation. So we're happy to provide that. But now we're moving on to an email from Kevin Scott. And he says, I give up. What am I missing? I have read My Teacher is a Martian 4 times now, and I have books from Zhou Haisheng to Journey to the Center of the Earth, but I still can't figure out the Easter eggs. Is it just me, or have others missed these? I was tempted to draw my own Easter eggs in the book so I could pretend I found them just to put my mind at ease. But I know that won't help me to forget. You're right. Can you give me some hints, just tiny ones, please? Anyway, I love your books and your podcast, and I'm not just saying that to get clues. All right. Well, Kevin Scott, I appreciate you writing an email because, you know, when I mentioned that there are Easter eggs, I've just been hearing nothing but crickets chirping. This is not the deluge of, you know, internet sleuths of, you know, coming banging down my door and all that I was imagining. But that's okay. I'm going to keep doing the Easter eggs. I'm kind of the Easter bunny in chief at our company. I will give you this piece of advice. The Easter eggs are largely in the illustrations.
Yes.
So if you're not looking at the illustrations, then you should be.
Yeah.
And to anyone who is also looking for Easter eggs or will be now, it's not just one book. It's not just that book. I'll admit that I've been putting forth more effort as we release more and more books.
Honestly, You've told me there's like a couple extra Easter eggs in Search of Juanma, and I don't know if I had found them.
Yeah, I don't think you can, Jared.
I got to spend a little more time on that.
You can learn Chinese, but you can't find my Easter eggs.
They're kind of like cross-referenced from the other books, right?
Right, right. So I once used the term MCU, Mandarin Companion Universe, and the idea is that everything is interconnected. So that's what the Easter eggs are related to. Part of the inspiration for what I've been doing is if you've seen these theories about like the Pixar universe, about how all the movies are in one universe and they're all somehow connected, it's kind of like that.
And I will say, from what I recall, there are a couple Easter eggs as well and Breakthrough that you may not get until you get to level 2 even.
Yeah, you're going to have to read more than one book to find them probably. Anyone that's finding Easter eggs, if you write us with something you found, what are we going to do, Jared?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we could. We'll have to think about it. But how about this? If you find an Easter egg, email us. We'll do something.
Okay, so on this topic of stories and how we choose our books, what our books are about, we actually want to talk about that today because we've gotten a lot of questions in the past about what story are you going to do next? How do you choose your stories? Or why aren't you doing this traditional Chinese classic instead of these Western stories? So today, we actually have a lot to say about this, and we want to share this with you. It's all relevant to learning Chinese and obviously Mandarin Companion, so let's do it.
You're going to see a little bit on how the sausage is made.
All right, so the first thing I want to talk about is story selection. So you guys may have noticed that we tend to choose stories from the Western canon classics. Quite critically, in terms of legality, we choose books that are in the public domain.
Yeah, so the public domain, just for any of the uninitiated, those are books where their copyright protection has expired. So, you know, copyright stops us from doing something like Frozen or taking like a Batman. We would like to probably do some of those in the future, but that's going to require some licensing and some bigger bucks than we've got.
Yeah, or even something as simple as like H.P. Lovecraft or Catcher in the Rye. Those are recent enough that they're still under copyright. They're not in the public domain.
Yeah, so that's kind of one of the first hurdles. Can we have the rights to it?
Now, that said, we do have some of our own original stories, like all of the Breakthrough titles, of which there are 5. They're all original stories. The reason for that is because we're trying to write stories at a very low level using a very limited set of characters, and being able to completely control the plot makes that way easier.
Yeah, so one of the things that John and I realized when we were starting out Mandarin Companion is that you think for a second of like how many books are written in a year? And then how many of those books like are good? And then how many of those books actually like make it? And then how many of those books actually have staying power for any length of time? And it's really, really a small set of books. And I think one of the takeaways is that it's hard to write a good story. And so we wanted to make sure that the Mandarin Companion series, first and foremost, it's got to be a good story. And so we wanted to draw upon some of the best stories from, you know, history and literature.
Yeah, and so if you've ever, you know, used a textbook, you've probably had this experience where you kind of feel like this dialogue was inspired, you know, in quotes there, inspired by the vocabulary and grammar that they had to use for this chapter. That does not tend to result in a riveting dialogue. That's something that we wanted to avoid for all of our stories, and we had to change tactics a little bit for the Breakthrough stories, but because we had, you know, a lot of experience adapting really quality stories, we felt that we were ready to tackle this challenge for Breakthrough.
So one of the big questions we get about our stories are saying, okay, so are these like translations of books? And we're like, not exactly, right? Because what we have to do is we find a story that we think is going to adapt well, and I guess you could say, in a sense, translate well into Chinese, but it is in no means a direct translation. And so when we're looking at a story, we first say, hey, is this a good story? And then, is this a story that we can then go ahead and adapt into one of our graded readers? And so, to kind of be clear about this, it's something where we take that story, and then John and I create an outline for that story. Now, it's based on the initial plot line, but it may not be that exact plot line.
To clarify what Jared said, it's not exactly a translation. It's not a translation at all, man. We have to rewrite the stories completely.
Yeah. It's much more than a translation.
It's an adaptation and a rewriting of the story.
So one of the first things that we really do when we try to adapt these stories is that we want to go ahead and take them out of, I guess, the native time period and setting and transpose that into a similar or an appropriate time period in China.
Right. And we have a lot to choose from because we have modern times, which is relevant to a lot of learners. And some stories lend themselves well to that, like Emma worked pretty well for that. But then some stories work better in a certain, you know, previous time period. And I think China does have a bit of that romance, like the charm of certain periods in history. So we want to use that too, if we can.
One of my favorite examples is what we did with the book Emma, is Jane Austen's Emma. We were thinking initially of doing in some sort of older time period when it wasn't as technologically advanced, but I was inspired by the movie Clueless, and we adapted that one, my wife Heather and I, to modern day Shanghai with smartphones and everything, and we had a really good time doing that story.
But that is something we have to be really careful about, because there are some stories where if you bring in smartphones, then it's going to introduce like huge plot holes. Because smartphones can solve a lot of the problems which drive the plot in some of these older stories.
It's so true.
So one of the other main concerns that we have when we're creating a new story is the topic and how that relates to vocabulary. Because, you know, we have our own standards for our levels and Mandarin Companion, and we have to be careful about choosing a story which is just not going to work vocabulary-wise. Like, we have actually written stories that we tried to write at a certain level and we had to abandon because the vocabulary is too much and it couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm.
To give an example of one that we didn't try because I knew it wouldn't work, even though Jared wanted to do it, is The Jungle Book.
Yeah.
That book is too animal-centric. And in Chinese, so many animals have their own characters and they're not high-frequency characters. As much as possible, we want the characters that you need in order to read our stories to be high-frequency characters. If not everyday vocabulary, then like character names for the lower levels should be common characters and common surnames, that kind of thing. Once you get into animal names, it's kind of a different level.
And this is a great example, John, because it's even beyond just those animal names, right? We have different animals that might pounce. We have animals that growl, and then they're swinging, and then there's all sorts of things for foliage in the rainforest. Like, you would know in your native language, right? But it's just not something that is going to be relevant to you as a learner.
Right. So specific verbs can introduce a lot of challenges that we sometimes have to avoid. Sometimes there are ways around it. Like, we got pretty creative with Journey to the Center of the Earth. I think you can feel a little bit that the description of what's going on, like in the climax, is not quite as precise as it could be. But sometimes you can get around it. But oftentimes it's better to just put a story on hold, maybe save it for a higher level.
And when that happens, sometimes we have to lean on the illustrations. 'Cause, you
know. No, actually, we don't do that, Jared. The illustrations help, but when we do the test readings, there are no illustrations. So one of the things that we do as part of our testing, this happens in Shanghai, so Jared actually doesn't see it very much. One of the things we want to do is make sure that the test readers can understand the story with no illustrations. And if some of their feedback is like, I don't know what's happening here, then that's something we take very seriously.
But John, I think something that's good to talk about here also is why we actually take the time to adapt them and set them into a time period of China. It's something that's kind of subtle that now that we mentioned it, you might like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But you know, it's really important to also get an understanding of Chinese culture along the way, because the more you can also understand the culture, the more it helps you make sense of the language and also helps you to communicate. And so by adapting it to China, we are able to introduce you two different cultural elements for people who may not be as familiar, but it's really helpful.
Yeah, because really, as you're learning a foreign language, especially as you get to the higher levels, learning that language well and being able to interact with the locals is also a process of adapting your brain to this different culture's way of thinking. I think there are parallels there, you know, things that we do for the stories that you're also doing as you're learning Chinese.
Now, there's some really interesting things that we come across when we're trying to adapt some of these stories and write them. This is where it's important when John and I get involved in helping bridging some of these, you know, cultural gaps, if you would say. Because, you know, honestly, John and I don't write the books.
Right. We have a team that write them, and I'm the editor in chief. So I oversee those writers and I'm, you know, closely working with them. But they're the ones that are putting fingers to keys, so to speak.
I think this goes to show is that it doesn't matter how good our Chinese is, it's just not going to be as good as if a native writes it. But I remember one story specifically, John, if you remember in The Secret Garden, at the very end of the story, I guess this might be a little bit of spoiler, but there's this rift between the father and the son.
Yeah.
And the father comes back in the home and his heart has changed and his son hears his father In the original story, he runs out of the garden and into his father's arms, and they hug and they cry. And this is very emotional and touching moment. It's just like the whole book builds to that. And it's just, you get this warm, fuzzy feeling. This is one of these reasons that this book is a classic. But that doesn't quite work in China. Like, it's just like fathers and sons don't exactly express their love and affection in that way. And the writer was like, I don't feel comfortable about this. This doesn't, like, a Chinese dad wouldn't do this, especially back in this time period.
I remember you were kind of fighting that one, right, Jared? You're like, but this has to happen.
I was fighting. I'm like, no, this is like the big payoff. But and then we talked about this, right? And finally you're like, okay, you're right. It doesn't fit. So what we had to do is we had to change that part of the story, and we coupled it with an illustration. And so we had the father had his hand on the son's shoulder, and they both have tears coming out of their eyes. And that tears is even a huge step, right? Huge cultural step.
Yeah, it was still like emotionally resonant, but it wasn't transplanted Western culture, you know?
Another one was when we did Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Curly Haired Company. Now, if any one of you guys are Sherlockians, you will know that this book is based off of Sherlock Holmes and the Red-Headed League. This is a fun adaptation because the original Sherlock Holmes story is set in England, and there are a lot of redheaded people in England. So in the original story, there's this league or, you know, a club, and the only people who can be in it are people who have red hair. So now we're trying to transpose this story to China. Well, there are just no redheaded people in China, and they're only... And so we're like, what do we do?
And
we thought
about
it. And
keep in mind, this is 1920s Shanghai. This is not like modern day China with lots of dyed hair.
That's right. So, you know, everyone's got black hair. But then we started doing some thinking about it. And we're like, well, hey, wait a second. China does have curly haired people. And curly haired people are just about as uncommon, maybe a little more uncommon in China than redheaded people are in the West. So boom, there we are. So now we have Sherlock Holmes and the Curly Haired League. But wait a second. We also, in China, we don't really have this concept of like a league or clubs or societies in the sense that we have them in the West. So, John, the thing we have in China, it's a little bit more shehui. It's more of a community thing.
Yeah, plus we kind of wanted to avoid that word at level one if we could.
So the society, the league thing didn't quite translate over, and they usually kind of have a little bit more community or government involvement. And so we said, oh, hey, how about we change this to the curly-haired company, 公司. So Sherlock Holmes and the Red-Headed League turned into Sherlock Holmes in the Case of the Curly-Haired Company.
So one of the other things that we spend a lot of time on is the character designs.
And on the illustrations part, I mean, we can have a lot of fun with those. And this is where some of those Easter eggs are. But, you know, something that's really important to John and I is like having that realism, capturing that essence of China in the illustrations, because you capture a lot of cultural elements. One of my favorite examples is the Great Expectations in level two. We set Great Expectations in Shanghai, and specifically book two is in Shanghai in the city area. You remember that, John? I spent a day just driving around. I spent like a lot of time scouting out on a map where to go and places like roads that we could use that had the characters in it that would match what we would be using in the book. And I got on my scooter and I rode around Shanghai for a whole day, took pictures of these streets, of these buildings, of these complexes. And so the places and the illustrations in Great Expectations are like real, like the real places. And the addresses are actually real. In fact, you could actually, this is a little Easter egg. Haha. Okay, giving away an Easter egg. But if you look for the addresses in Great Expectations, put them into maps.baidu.com and you can find the actual location.
Man, imagine that thrill, huh?
Wow.
You were talking about the authenticity of the illustrations being important. So all of our illustrators have always been Chinese. So they definitely get it when we say we want like a certain era of China or a certain feel. But when it comes to the cover design, and, you know, contrary to popular sayings, cover designs are really important. One of the things I've been doing a lot is I'll just sketch out the design myself, and then the illustrator will make it look awesome. Actually, one of the things I've done recently is I've done some kind of tributes to certain like classic movie posters as part of the cover design. So there's another Easter egg that you guys can look for.
And, you know, doing the breakthrough levels, like those are so different than even this process that we were, you know, just describing to everyone here. we wanted to do like some popular stories, but when you can only write a story and you've got only how many nouns do we have, John? Like 10?
Yeah. So the breakthrough character set is a subset of the level one character set, and it's only 150 characters. And this was a conversation I had so many times with Jared. I was getting really sick of it. Jared's like, but if we just introduce like one or two more characters, then we can blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, Jared, no more characters. This is the set. And it was rough. It was rough.
It was. You handcuffed us, right? And I was so frustrated for like a couple months. I'm like, John, if we just like 5 new characters, then we can actually adapt a story. But John stuck to his guns. He's like, nope. Because the thing about that breakthrough level is you see, okay, level one uses only 300 characters and breakthrough uses only 150 characters. And the thing about breakthrough is that it has keywords that lie outside of that 150 character set, but any of those keywords have to fall within the level one standard. So within that 300. And so you're super restricted and we can only use a subset of those because otherwise it gets too hard for the breakthrough level.
And to compare a little bit, for level one, we do allow a few like fairly common, not too hard words that aren't in the level one standard. And that's really important for giving us a little bit of flexibility to adapt new stories. But we didn't allow that for breakthrough. Like I put my foot down. I was like, no, Jared, we have to think of the learners. It is hard to learn Chinese. They have enough characters to worry about. We're not adding new ones.
And so here's the true story of how breakthrough finally came about. After months of wrangling on how we're going to do this, is I had to fly to Shanghai, and you and I, we sat down, locked ourselves in a room for like a couple hours to hammer out our first story. And we have like these sheets with all the characters and possible combinations of words we can use. And we're like, so let's have this. And, you know, and then we keep shooting everything down until finally we find a path through a story that's going to work with the vocab that we have.
It is definitely hard. And I totally understand why a lot of other graded readers aren't so strict with their leveling. They're just harder.
And it's one of these things too, of like, once you just say, all right, well, we'll just add one more character, right? But then it can be a slippery slope, right? Because you're like, oh, well, just one more. And then, okay, maybe one more. And then, oh, if we just add this last one, then we can do this.
As we were developing Breakthrough, I could just see Jared there at the top of that slippery slope with his sled being like, let's just add this one character. You know, I knew what he was trying to do. Didn't let it happen.
You know, I think this is a good note to end on because, you know, honestly, John, I've said this before, but I think one of the strengths of our series is that, frankly, you and I, we don't always see eye to eye, right? And it's that push-pull process that I think pushes us to make sure that we find something that's not just going to be work, but it's good. It's pretty cool. It's kind of magical.
All right. So the thing about today's podcast is I don't think we need a word from our sponsor because so far, all we've been doing is a word from our sponsor, right?
We didn't really mean it to be like that, guys, but we had a lot of questions about this.
All right, so now we've got rants and raves.
All right, what do you got for us, John? You got a rant or do you have a rave?
I think I'm on like a positive kick. I got another rave.
Yay.
I remember like when I first got here to Shanghai, you know, in the 2000s, I would see a lot of crazy English on T-shirts. This term English was sometimes used, which I think maybe is a little racist. I don't know.
English is also a little more Japanese, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, but it was just so like sometimes just random typed letters. It's not even words. But I've noticed that things have really changed. So now when I go around Shanghai and I look at T-shirts, some of them are really thought-provoking. And it's like, is that like from a name brand or is that just some random Chinese dude making T-shirts and selling them Taobao? Like they're in like this weird gray area. So my rave is for these weird T-shirts, and I'm going to share a few of them. And they're usually all caps, solid color shirt, plain text. So it's not like a high production T-shirt. All right. Money creates taste. Someday, somewhere, someone. Fun day. Wrecked. Yesterday, you said tomorrow, which I feel like is a Shia LaBeouf reference. But anyway. Now is now. Violence, terror, chaos.
Violence, terror, chaos.
100% nothing.
100% nothing.
Online, I just feel strong. White girl.
White girl.
And by the way, she wasn't white. But anyway, blah, blah, blah.
Punch me in the face. I need to feel alive.
Freak in the street. tomato ketchup. No pictures, not an ad, just tomato ketchup. And finally, one I saw in Spanish was cerrado por alguna razón.
Nice. I like it.
So closed for some reason. Yeah, so it's fun seeing these t-shirts. That is my rave.
That reminds me, have you seen that Mama Hoo Hoo short? I think it's called Chinglish Solves Everything. It's about this guy. He's walking around the streets of Shanghai.
Oh,
and he just
looks
like guys wearing like those Chinglish shirts, and he just repeats whatever he sees on them. It's the best.
But see, that's a good example of like how the t-shirts used to be.
Good stuff.
All right. So Jared, what do you got? Rant or rave?
A rave.
All right.
This is a website I came across recently. It's called visualizingchina.net. So visualizingchina.net. It's a blog that is part of this Historical Photographs of China project. And so this was started by this professor from the University of Bristol called Robert Brickers. And what he's done is he's trying to collect all these old photos of China that were previously like among like family collections that are just been like in private, I guess, families in a shoebox or something who had people who were in China back in, you know, the early years of photography. And he's been collecting these over the years, and they've been putting them online. And what's happening is like these researchers are taking these pictures and they're plugging them in with the stories that they know and the research that's been done about different aspects of history of China. And it's super cool. It's really, really interesting. And so they have, you know, Facebook page and they have all this stuff, but everything's on their website. And so I came across an article I had found is about the city walls and gates of Shanghai. And I thought it was really interesting because there is still a small section of the city walls in Shanghai. So it's down in this area near Xiaonanmen in Huangpu in the southern area. It's kind of like old Shanghai area. So if you're interested in history of China and you want to find, you know, some old photos and see some stuff that you probably won't be seeing anywhere else, go check it out. It's called visualizingchina.net.
All right. So today we have an interview with one of my old friends from my Chinese pod days, right?
Oh, yes. This guy, he's like searching archives of like handwritten documents from like the late 1800s, early 1900s. This is like next level stuff.
This guy is hardcore.
You can just call me Pete. My full name is Pete Braden.
Something we didn't quite get to, but Pete can do amazing Clinton and Elvis impersonations in Chinese.
I am currently a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. I'm still writing and revising my dissertation, which was called Serve the People, Bovine Experiences in China's Civil War and Revolution, 1935 to 1961.
For some of us, Chinese is a hobby or a tool. But for Pete, Chinese is his career, and quite a good one at that. Pete has some awesome stories that you're going to want to hear. Stay with us.
So if your listeners are familiar with 20th century Chinese history, they'll know that's a very dense period. Lots of activity.
Tumultuous.
Tumult, precisely. But we typically think of it solely from a human perspective. And I was thinking, well, hey, at that time, there were about 50 million bovines. That's a group that includes cattle, water buffalo, and yaks.
Yeah, that's why I'm like, we're talking about species and bovines. I mean, yeah, so this is not human history yet.
I like to call it not human or not animal history, but multi-species history, because in fact, I do pay a lot of attention to humans who were involved in these events, but I'm also very serious about the animals. What was it like for them? Mm. Put it one way, if you were an ox in China in 1940, how would your life be different from the life of an ox in China in 1960? And that's a pretty challenging question to answer, but I try in each of the chapters, I focus on a particular bodily fluid that represents some aspect of a bovine's life. So the first chapter is milk. So that is about the way that the growth of a dairy industry in China changed not only the fact that human women could put their children in a nursery and then go work in the paid workforce, compensated workforce, but it also changed the relationships between dams, you know, female cows, and their calves, because to collect milk, you have to separate the calf and the cow, and what was that like on their,
yeah,
you know, from their emotional and biological and physiological life. And then there are subsequent chapters on sweat How did their workload change with land reform? The number of hours they had to work, the number of mu that they had to plow. That's just a unit of surface area that they had to plow. You know, those are things for which we have pretty rich empirical data. I have a chapter on... Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's something, you know, that they took good statistics about. Now, I take it a step further than just describing the number of acres or mu that they had to plow by looking at, you know, how did they experience exhaustion? You know, what was your workload and hours per day? Are you being treated more gently or more harshly by a farmer who owns you as opposed to a farmer who uses you as part of a commune, you know?
Yeah. That's fascinating. So, I mean, you're covering like topics that like I had never even considered, you know.
Well, that's my hope, you know. History, in my opinion, should be not just, hey, let's ratify the established narratives that we all have and the kind of simplified stories, but let's in fact poke and see where can we find things that are surprising or controversial and challenging to think about. So that's what I'm aiming to do. And I should say the title of the dissertation, Serve the People, is of course based on the slogan, Wei Zhen Min Fu Wu. But in this case, you know, which is, as Chairman Mao was saying, the Chinese Communist Party should serve the people. But I'm making a kind of play on words in which the bovines are being made to better serve the people. So in each chapter about a different bodily fluid, the kind of the through line is that humans were trying to make these animals more productive, more obedient, get more labor power out of them or more flesh out of them. And so, you know, that's basically the argument of the project.
Wow, that's really interesting. And so I'm kind of curious to know, like, how did this whole start? How did you get started in Chinese, period?
When I was in high school, I was studying French and Latin. I went to a public high school, but I was very fortunate to get excellent training in both of those Romance languages.
Latin.
But I thought, hey, maybe it would be cool to study those in college. And in fact, my top choice for college, which I was accepted, but then ultimately found physically unfit for, was West Point, the military academy. Mm. I wanted to go into the United States Army and be an officer, and ideally I wanted to be a special forces operative and work in foreign countries learning, you know, the local languages. Remember, I was of the generation where 9/11 happened when I was in high school, and I was from a military family. So I had a very kind of national security-oriented perspective, and I thought, well, it would be great to put foreign languages to work to make America safe and so on. And when I was found unfit for military service, I said, well, I got to think of some other way to do that. And by that point, I was in college, and my advisor said, well, it seems like the best options would be either Arabic or Mandarin. And it was really just that. I just, well, I'll just do Mandarin. I just took the language, you know, for a year, thinking that I would be able to go into the CIA or the NSA or some other organization whose name I don't even know, whatever. That was around the time that the Iraq War was spinning out of control, and I was not a big fan of American foreign policy, and I was also getting to travel to China. I got to travel for 2 summers to China, and I also lived for 1 summer in a Buddhist monastery in Taiwan called Fo Guangshan, the Buddha's Light Mountain. But I wasn't doing this as much of a pilgrimage as just, hey, I'd like to learn about how people in the real world practice this faith. And those things just made it seem less and less appealing to try to use my Chinese language for, you know, national security purposes. So now, as an educator, I hope to nurture a sense of understanding, curiosity, and inquiry and friendship among people which of different cultures, Chinese and Western and so on, and that would be my contribution to making a better earth.
You know, it's kind of interesting to hear that. Just recently, my wife and I were talking about how 8 years in China and just how significantly that changed my worldview.
Yes, and there's plenty to criticize in governments, whether it's the United States government, whether it's the Communist Party, you know, there's plenty to criticize, but I stopped thinking that violence would be a way to solve problems. And I started to have a lot of attachments to people in China and just thinking it would not be great if we ended up in a war with these people. How about we solve our differences in a different way?
Yeah.
One of the funny things, the first instance I had of culture shock in China, I went over for my senior year in college. I was doing a full year abroad. I was an exchange student at Fudan University in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. This would have been September of 2005. I arrived in China right on the day of Hurricane Katrina, to give you some context. I was riding my bike to the Carrefour or one of the other little stores there, going to get some groceries. And there was a guy, like a middle-aged Chinese dude, and he was setting off all these fireworks. And what really got me was that he was kind of just giggling very joyfully. But it struck me as so bizarre that it's like 2 p.m. and here's a guy running around and setting off fireworks, and everyone is clapping, and he was launching a business, I now realize. It was a pretty common thing to do. You want to make some noise and have a great time. But it kind of shocked me. I said, oh my goodness, what kind of a nation have I just arrived in where grown men are setting off fireworks at midday? And that, also, I tell that story just as like, it shows how kind of square I was.
There's like so many small little things like that, right? When you go to a new country, it's like, whoa, that's different. I didn't expect that.
Yes, it is. I was in Jiangxi province a couple summers after that, visiting the family of a Chinese friend who I had met in Shanghai. I went with a different Chinese buddy. It just shows how welcoming people can be, that basically a Chinese buddy and I in Shanghai went to the home of a girl we knew from Shanghai who was not even going to be there. I mean, it was just her family's home, but they just said, hey, you and your friends would like to come and visit our little farm, and they were happy to do that. So we took the train down to Lushan, and we went to this farm, and they had a little place where there was like a barn. We had a little meal in the barn, and then they go, hey, do you want to use the bathroom? I said, yeah. So they go, it's right out in the back. And they had essentially their pig sty, and you'd go into this kind of almost like an igloo where the pig was, and there was a rope hanging from the ceiling, and you just hang onto the rope and kind of lean your backside off the end, and the pig is down there, snorting away, and that's like a full,
bombs away,
bombs away. It's the circle of life, And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. By that time, I was really getting into the idea of sustainability and everything, and I thought, man, they're way ahead of us on this.
Well, that's one thing I love about Chinese culture, is very practical,
Oh yeah. I mean, you can't afford to waste nutrients.
I like that story, Peter, because it really highlights to me that how different even the culture can be regionally around China.
Mm.
I've experienced that, where some people in some areas that just seem so open, they could welcome you into their home, right? But I mean, in a place like Shanghai, that doesn't really kind of happen.
Well, yeah, maybe so. I mean, as I say, I arrived right at the time of Katrina, and probably a week into that whole mess, I was out running at the track, and this fella saw me there. And this is a kind of a situation that does happen, where the local person is trying to practice some English. Mm-hmm. And so in that context, people will reach out to you.
Absolutely.
I was running around, and this guy, he goes, hey, he was probably in his 40s. He goes, hey, you want to go out for dinner? And I said, okay. So we went out. He paid for some dumplings. At that time, I still ate meat, and we were having a great conversation. He goes, you want to come to my house and then meet my family? And I said, sure. So we went to his family, and they gave me some bananas and stuff. And then we're watching the TV, and I just remember they were just appalled watching the catastrophe unfolding in New Orleans. And they just looked at me, and they're like, we kind of didn't expect to see this in the USA. And I said, yeah, man, neither did I. But I should point out to your readers, I'm probably kind of eccentric in the sense that I'm also a couch surfer. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, couch surfing is awesome. If I haven't done it, but I've been interested in it.
Yeah. Now, in the pandemic, it's another thing that I'm not doing, but there is a kind of a website where you can just make your house or a bedroom or something available to people from other cultures. And then often when you're traveling, it's a kind of a pay it forward thing. I've never gotten any money or anything. It's just international exercise in radical trust and friendship and everything. And I've hosted probably 100 people in over a decade on couch surfing. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's been a blast from people from all around. But the point is, I have a kind of almost extreme, I don't know if you'd call it reckless, attitude of like, hey, let's just see where this will take us. So you can have a great time in China, even if you don't want to go out for dumplings with some random dude from the track, is the point.
Well, Pete, something I want to know a little bit about is, like, you know, what were you doing to, you know, learn Chinese throughout this process? Because it seems like you put yourself out there with a lot of opportunities to use your Chinese. How did that combine with, you know, what you were doing to actually study to build your proficiency in the language?
When I arrived in China, I just carried a little shouzi, a little notebook in my back pocket everywhere I went with a mechanical pencil, and I would just write down things. Often I'd see something on the side of a truck or, somebody would tell me something or I wouldn't understand. So I would just constantly be writing things down and then studying them. And that was before smartphones. As I mentioned, I studied Latin in high school, and one of the techniques that my teacher at that time taught us and I practiced, I think, pretty successfully was something called a four-column study, where you would take a sheet of notebook paper and fold it into four vertical columns. And then in the first column on the left, you'd write your Latin word. And then in the next column, you'd do the English. And then you'd cover up the first column. And from that English, could you reproduce the Latin? And then you'd cover up the Latin, and then could you reproduce English? And so on. And all the way across both sides of a piece of paper. And by the time you've done that and forced your brain to do that work of retrieval and copying and saying the words out loud and doing the physical act of writing, all of those, I believe, are part of the learning process. Anyway, by the time you've done that, the word is quite well cemented. Now, when I started to study Chinese, you have to do an extra step. You have to really do a six-column study because, after all, you've got Hanzi, Pinyin, and English, right? So my practice was always to do the Chinese character, the pinyin, and then the English. And again, very important to say things out loud and, you know, not be ashamed of that and just, you know, get the stroke order right and all these kind of extra steps, the tones. Of course, the pinyin should include the tones. And once you do that and work your way around the page, you know, you're well on your way to having that character. And I know that, again, that's rote learning. A lot of people would say that's kind of barbaric or primitive or whatever, but all I can say is I had pretty good success with it. And the other thing that I think helped me a lot with acquiring the Chinese language was the fact that when I was a kid, I still play the violin, but when I was a kid, I studied with something called the Suzuki method, which
I've
was
heard of that, yeah.
It's basically a form of learning where the teacher, they don't put so much emphasis on reading the sheet music as much as they do on the teacher playing passage of the song and then the student replicating it, playing it by ear. So essentially training yourself to play things by ear. And the reason I think that helped me is not so much because Chinese is a tonal language or a musical language or anything like that, but you can think of it as like it increases the RAM in your brain. It gives you a better working memory of, I just heard a snippet and it sounded like this, and you know, let me think about that and see if I can make those sounds myself. And so that was a pretty helpful preparatory step as well.
Well, that sounds really cool. I like that Suzuki method and also about carrying around a notebook. You know, one of the things about that is that, you know, when we always talk about learning Chinese, you know, a common thing that, you know, we say, and I'm sure you believe in too, is like learn things that are relevant to you, right?
Yes.
And if you have that notebook, you're probably writing it down because it was in a conversation. And because it came up in a conversation, it's likely more relevant to you than perhaps some arbitrary word list out of a textbook, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, Chinese people are just justifiably, in my opinion, proud of the complexity and the richness of their language. And so it's also a very good conversation starter. If someone introduced themselves and says, hey, my name is, you know, He Shubin or Pan Ji or whatever, and you say, 怎么写? And then they, oh, get the pen out, and you know this one, you know what this means?
Yeah.
And then people would, they want to thumb through the previous entries. What else have you been learning? Oh, you learned this. Oh, do you know how they say it in Taiwan? It's different, you know, and things like this. So even today, frankly, if I had to learn Chinese over again, I know they have a lot of apps and stuff, and I don't want to speak ill of anything or whatever, but I would still think that there's a lot of value in having the physical notebook and just carrying that sucker around. And it's a real feeling of accomplishment when you get done with one. I have like probably 10 of them at my home back in New wow. York that I just hung on to. I was like, hey, these are kind of, you know, souvenirs of my Chinese mm-hmm. learning, you know.
Overall, John and I, we don't recommend for people to learn to handwrite, right? Because you know, right?
Really?
Much, yeah. Because, you know, the amount of time it takes to learn to handwrite, you know, you're laughing because you know how long it takes to learn. Because handwriting characters is a skill in and of itself. But usually what we recommend is like, we learned the concept of handwriting, sure, write some characters, but, you know, focus on typing because the learning curve is not as much there. So I'm curious what you would say about that.
Well, of course, it varies by the listener and what they're aiming to do with the language professionally or personally or whatever. For me, it was very fortunate that I had done so much handwriting because as I am doing a lot of my historical research now, going to archives in China, whenever I'm allowed back into the country after this pandemic, I've spent almost a year doing archival research yeah. in Chinese. And the benefit of having a pretty solid grasp on handwritten characters for me was that it allows you to decipher handwritten characters. In other words, a lot mm-hmm. of the documents that I'm looking at were written by people in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and it's almost like a kind of empathy that you have with the writer in the sense that you know, well, they must have started with this thing and then they would have done the internal bit and so on. And then, oh, I see, they're doing guo or
this,
whatever.
This is like next level stuff. I mean,
yeah.
You're going back through archival records, like looking at handwritten documents from like 100 years ago. I mean, whoa, dude, this is crazy stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of my classmates did his undergraduate at Oxford and had a very renowned professor called Craig Clunas. He's a professor of Chinese art. He said, if he can read the calligraphy, then it's not good calligraphy.
You know? Yeah, that's a good.
You know, but I agree with you and John as far as I don't think it's probably worthwhile for the average student to learn how to do calligraphy. That's a whole other
yeah.
can of worms.
Yeah.
But being able to read handwritten documents, you know, if you're going to do anything that involves looking at material from the past, I don't feel that the time I spent was wasted. I'll put it that way. I'll tell you, a funny thing is that, you know, the handwriting of officials, people working in the government during the nationalist period was considerably better than during the PRC. Do you have any sense why that might be?
I'm okay. Assumption is that nationalist period, they were looking for more qualified, whereas in the afterwards is more political connection. Would that be accurate?
Basically, what happened was a lot of these people that were writing stuff in the nationalist period were extremely well-educated and had studied abroad, some of them, or they had certainly gone to intensive training in China, whereas it's a pretty stark contrast when you start seeing documents from the early 50s when cadres, like petty officials who were just essentially a couple weeks ago used to be a farmer, and so they might have some functional literacy, but they were not good writers, you know, so their writing turns into this kind of childish scribbling. The way I said that sounds condescending, but it just means I respect their work, you know.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. So I'd love to hear. I mean, do you have any cool experiences about, you know, diving through some of these archives that related to your research? Even as a foreigner, how do you get access to the stuff? Where is this stuff? I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, when I was in China in 2017, I was in the country for about 6 months. And of that time, maybe a half of it was actually spent holding the documents and deciphering them and getting to use them. A great deal of the time was spent begging for letters of introduction, having dinners with people who might introduce me to people who could give me letters of introduction. So there is a lot of guanxi, you know, these relationships. And many of my friends, both in American universities and in Chinese academia, helped me out. And it's an inconvenience to them, and they don't want to burn those bridges. But they reached out, hey, this guy, he's doing a project. It's not especially sensitive, although, of course, I do talk about the Great Leap Forward and the starvation and so on. It's not as if I was researching collaboration with the Japanese or something, but it's still, you know, it's still
sensitive
a fairly
subjects, yeah.
So, The long and short of it is that a lot of your effort has to be devoted to just getting yourself into the archives and then establishing for the people who run them, mm-hmm. who are usually, unlike in the United States, the people running the archives in China are often not archivists. They don't have like a master's in library science or anything. It's just like a person who's got a job, you know.
My job. I'm just here to protect this stuff, right?
I'm just drinking some tea and I'll come around and look over your shoulder. What are you reading? Oh, that's very interesting. You know, this kind of thing. So that creates its own set of challenges. But I guess as far as learning Chinese goes, that's an important point that you might think, hey, this guy, Pete, is a historian. Mostly he's going to be dealing solely with written texts and ancient documents and so on. So maybe there's not much of a need for him to be fluent in conversational Chinese. But in fact, if you're going to go and do research, even if you're reading mostly these older documents, if you're going to go and do research, you need to be able to talk to the archivists and the librarians and the academics who have these special collections. Otherwise, you're just unable to get your hands on the materials that you need to read. So, you know, I encourage everybody to try to see all of the aspects of learning Chinese as interwoven, listening, speaking, writing, and so on.
Well, you know, Pete, something I'd love to hear from your perspective. You have delved through some unique materials that few foreigners have had access to. Not just that, if you delve through them, you're actually able to read them, handwritten stuff, you know. What do you think is maybe a unique insight or two that you have gained along the way that maybe the average person wouldn't be exposed to?
Yeah, well, I taught for a week, whatever they call this, a training camp, something that I thought was affiliated with the school of crazy English. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I've heard. A guy like shouts English or... I remember. But anyway,
there was a guy. Now he has been revealed as a wife beater, so he's kind of fallen out of favor, this guy. But anyway, he was packing stadiums in China, Japan, and South Korea, largely, where the idea was to go and shout, you know, I love learning English.
Yeah.
I love, you know, and here's the key thing. I love making mistakes. Mm. I love losing face. And not being afraid to make mistakes. That's really where you are going to make progress, is making mistakes and learning from them and just getting over yourself. Well, the funny thing is, the crazy English boot camp that I thought I was affiliated with turned out to just be a guy who had some pirated materials. He wasn't kicking anything back to the actual institution of crazy English. So.
Sounds like a pretty normal Chinese story there.
Yeah. You know, this guy named Stone, he paid me in a wad of sweaty cash. And I was, you know.
Untraceable. Yeah. Except through DNA sweat,
untraceable,
right?
Cash. Yeah. So, you know, that was a good laugh. I mean, that was 15 years ago. But as far as learning Chinese, you know, your listeners, you got to recognize I still make mistakes. I still, you know, have lots of room to improve. I always will. It's much better to make a mistake and move on than to just keep to yourself and feel shy and ashamed and not want to talk to anyone because they'll hear you have an accent or something. You got to just set that aside, you know, leave your ego at the door, so to speak. Another thing, a thing that has always stuck with me was, you know, John may have told you when I was at Chinese Pod, his old company, I was doing a podcast called Chinese Poems with Pete.
Oh, he did.
So I have always been really interested in classical poetry, particularly, you know, Tang poetry, particularly if we want to get really specific, Li Xiangyin, like Wan Tang, like this kind of melancholy vision of a country declining and watching the sun set on the empire. I don't know why, as an American in 2020, that would resonate with me, but in any case, I really love that poetry, that classical poetry, and it was incredible to me how much knowledge of it ordinary, you know, civilians would have. One instance that really stuck with me was, as I mentioned, I spent a month at Foguangshan in Taiwan in 2005, and they had a little talent show. And so all the 40 foreign, whatever we were called, you know, we were not monks, but we were just students. We shaved our heads. Anyway, we were told, hey, you know, why don't you do a talent show? And just, you know, so one guy played the harmonica, people did this and that. And I said, well, I'll recite a classical poem. And I went up on the stage, and this is like 20 characters long, and yeah. I got halfway through. And you're in this auditorium of like 2,000 people. You know, the monastery is enormous.
Wow.
Nuns and monks. That's one monastery that has more nuns than monks. Kind of unusual.
Wow.
And I got halfway through my poem, and I forgot how it ended. But here's the crazy thing. Almost in unison, the crowd guided me through the rest of it. They started to kind of like very softly, like, you know, just get it out. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I, you know, got through the last thing. So they were very generous about the whole thing. You know, it was just a nice experience.
That's really neat.
It's no exaggeration to say that the language, particularly the written language, holds the Chinese civilization together. Now, here's the kind of the sad corollary to that, though, in my opinion, is that I wish that Chinese pedagogy had a better way of inculcating that love of the poetry without what seems to be 99% of the time people get frustrated with the poems. And so what happens is they learn a bunch of them in high school and they have to cram them. And or maybe even they have to learn them when they're like 4 years old and recite them for grandma and grandpa and stuff. And then they don't really, they almost resent them. That's the crazy thing. Mm. Like a lot of people I've met have a kind of like, it's just something I had to learn. It's tedious. It's stupid. You know, I was just thinking it's a pity there's not a better way to get kids to get that firm mastery of the Chinese classical poetry and all the philosophical insights and the aesthetic charm without beating the joy out of them as far as, you know, getting them to remember it. Because you really would struggle to find a corpus or a body of work that you could have the same effect that I had in that monastery, where if I started reciting a Shakespearean play, you know, could 2,000 people fill up the rest of the monologue? No way. I mean, maybe pop songs or something people would be able to do, but that classical literature is such an essential part of people's kind of mental furniture, and yet so many people are kind of frustrated with it and they want to get IKEA instead. You know?
Yeah, I think that's probably something that's ubiquitous across some cultures. What advice would you give to someone who's starting to learn Chinese right now?
Let's say they're just starting today. As much as possible, get in a room with people who speak only Chinese. It's kind of like the old Chinese story of, you know, burning the boats so that the army cannot retreat across the river. If you associate with like the security guard and the Ayi and whoever, and you can chat with people and they're not trying to get English lessons from you and you're not trying to get ahead in your career or whatever by flattering them, you're just having a candid conversation with people who your only common language is Chinese, it forces you to improve. So if you're going to go and study in China, stay away from the bars. I love a good beer. I love a good whiskey. But, you know, you want to be not hanging around with the expats. You want to be hanging around with the karaoke people, the Chinese people. I should have mentioned karaoke, by the way. That's another great learning thing. And I have to attribute a lot of my confidence in Chinese just to go into karaoke.
Oh, fun.
And you follow the bouncing ball at the bottom of the screen and you're singing, you're having a great time.
For our people who may not know, in China, that's called KTV, karaoke TV.
K-gu. Yeah.
KTV.
Yeah, KTV. I mean, I spent many lovely mornings. I lived in Nanjing and we used to just go stone cold sober and do like from 10 a.m. to noon and then go out and have lunch afterwards. And it would just be like me and four Chinese friends. And we just sing the greatest hits of the 80s, you know, which was like, I have a soft spot. If your listeners are looking for, I've often struggled with the fact that Chinese music, a lot of it, like a lot of modern American music, seems like garbage. But if you want to hear some really great music, check out a singer called Wang Fei. Mm-hmm. She was just so cool, you know, so we would just sing Wang Fei songs, and Zhou Jielun is another great one. And, you know, just building vocabulary and just practicing the skill of using your Chinese in front of others, mm-hmm. in a low stakes kind of setting. So karaoke and conversations with people who can't answer in English is probably your greatest allies.
Well, that's really cool. Well, Peter, I really appreciate you being on our podcast, sharing your wisdom and insights and amazing experiences with us. I mean, it's been really cool to hear all this. Hey, so Pete, if someone wants to find you, how could they get in touch with you?
You can Google my name, basically, and that's P-E-T-E-R, and then my surname is Braden, B-R-A-D-E-N. Right now, you'll see I'm on the Fairbanks Center's website. If you want to get in touch with me, I'd be happy to chat with you or whatever.
Great. Well, Pete, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Bye now.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, Christmas tree decorator, stocking hanger, foot warmer, nature hiker, gingerbread house designer, theater goer, prospective driver, cinnamon roll baker, and that one girl named Emily. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. If you feel like you've got an interesting story to tell about learning Chinese, reach out to us. If we're desperate enough, we just might get you on the podcast. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. And I'd like to thank our guest, Peter Braden. And of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pastor. See you next time.